Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 6 for 2019 of Refs Roundup. It's great to be back in the studio to chat about the weekend's games and everything that's been happening in the world of refereeing. And as always, a very lovely welcome to my favourite NRL referee and my favourite husband, Gavin Badger. Hello, Gavin.
Hey, Case, how are you?
Pretty good. How was your weekend? Tell me about how it all went. We had quite a lengthy discussion last week about what you were up to. So let's have a bit of a chat about how that went, how you found it, and what the process is from here.
It's funny starting a game at 1:40 instead of normally, you know, 4 o'clock or 7:30, which generally most of our NRL games are. So yeah, the biggest difference was that my day was shorter. You know, and something that you sort of take for granted, you don't realize that, you know, all of a sudden I'm like, oh wow, I better start getting ready for footy. Normally I've got a bit more time to relax and sit around and go shopping as I normally do. Right. So so that was probably the biggest difference. And getting to the ground a bit earlier and, you know, warming up when there's no one in the crowd and there's no game on before. You know, usually I like to sit there and watch a bit of the New South Wales Cup game or the flag game that they have prior to the NRL. So I didn't get to do, and there was a flag game on there, but yeah, it's just a little bit different. And then into the game, I really enjoyed it. Like, I had a lot of fun. Not that I want to do it too often. I'd much prefer to be out there in the NRL, but just the interaction with players, the less scrutiny. I'm not under as much scrutiny at that level. I'm still under scrutiny, obviously, but being able to interact and you know, have a bit more communication with players on the field was pretty cool.
So does that feel like there's quite a bit less pressure on you in the fact that, you know, we don't have 20-something camera angles and, you know, commentators on a game and just that, like you said, just that scrutiny and the pressure of the NRL level. Do you find that you're able to, I guess, be a bit more relaxed? Like you say, your comms with players, you know, there's certain things, you know, within reason that you can and can't say, you know, at the NRL level compared to at a reserve grade level. Do you find that just to be a bit more relaxing, which helps with your overall enjoyment of the game?
Yeah, I think so. And I think in general, the fact that, you know, it's not going to be overly scrutinised, the game, during it. So, yeah, it's not a TV game, obviously, so I was able to go out there and not worry about having, you know, super slow-mo replays and stuff like that on every decision I make. So that does make it easier to make decisions. If that, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it just, you're much more relaxed when you're making them because you know they're not going to be over scrutinised.
Yeah.
And I think it made me more relaxed on the field as well.
Well, that thing of, like you say, when you're making decisions, that a lot of the times something we say is it is what it looks like, a decision.
Yeah.
Without a super slow replay, you know, which can capture things at a speed that the human eye can't see, you're able to referee to just a bit more of a purity of, what does that look like? We say, you know, our pig decisions, you know, if it looks like a pig and it smells like a pig, it's a pig. And we talk about that a lot of times with decisions where we can, you know, with the technology at the highest level, sometimes we get down to what it technically is, which sometimes isn't what it actually just looks like.
Yeah. And for me, the biggest thing, walking away from the game, and even during, I remember the first set of the game, and I was thinking, you know, the speed of the game, and this is no disrespect to that level of football, but the speed between the NRL and that level, it's very hard to explain the difference, because the first couple of sets, and I found myself thinking, it seemed really slow in the ruck, and, you know, and the contact and stuff seemed really different. I'm thinking, is it me? Are my expectations too high, or is this a slow game of football?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Are the players taking me on here?
Yeah.
And it took me about 5 minutes to realise that, you know, it's a little bit of both.
To adjust to that level.
Yeah, and I had to adjust to the speed there. And then once I found the right medium, it seemed to run really well.
Yeah. So it was running quite well until about, what, the 12th minute of the game? So something that you wouldn't have had to do for a very long time, because we don't, you know, with the at the NRL level with the bunker and replays and all the rest of it, we generally don't send players off our own bat, because we always have time. And lots of times if there is a send-off, we know that it is, but we get that 100% confirmation, you know, from the bunker.
Yeah.
You had an incident in your game with a tackle where, you know, you're on your own and you've got to make that decision. Do you want to talk through that?
Oh, yeah, and it's just another factor of refereeing that at the NRL level, you know, we don't often have to do just because of the players, you know, the discipline and stuff. So we don't get a lot of send-offs because of the, you know, what happens out there. And then, yeah, if we do find ourselves in that situation, we have a lot of support. I have another referee out in the field that can give me some information. I also have the bunker that can come in and
so it fills you with confidence. You know 100% that you're right.
Yeah, in this instance, I'm out there by myself and I make a decision and it's a decision to send off a player. And, you know, that's just another decision I had to make in that game.
Yeah. All right. Anything else out of the weekend? So I know yesterday you and I went out to Bankwest Stadium, had a great afternoon out there. We're pretty happy to be able to get out there for the first NRL game. Just as rugby league fans, it was something that you and I had looked forward to for quite a while. Seemed to be sitting directly in the sun to work on the tan out there. But, it was a great facility. Great things for, you know, to take families out there. We're talking about, you know, how out the front there's like basketball courts and little play equipment and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, the facilities inside the stadium are just, you know, fantastic. And the game tossed up a performance from one team, from both teams that I guess a lot of people didn't really expect. You know, with Blake Ferguson ruled out fairly late with that rib injury, we sort of thought, you know, it'd be a fairly tight contest. And Parramatta just blew them off the park.
Yeah, and I talk a little bit about fan experience because we tried to have the whole fan experience yesterday. We don't often get to do it a lot because of obviously work and stuff like that. So we both had the day off, or most of the day off. We had training in the morning, but we had most of the day off. So we decided to go out early and, you know, we sat in a bar in Parramatta and watched, you know, the pre-game on the TV there and, you know, sort of interacted with people, you know, fans and spoke about, you know, their experience and what they were looking forward to. And it just was a really good vibe around, you know, we're in Church Street at Parramatta before the game, and just the proximity of having, you know, the restaurants and that scene so close to the stadium so that people can enjoy that before the game. It was buzzing. Mm. Like Parramatta was buzzing 2-3 hours before kickoff. So we got to enjoy that and then walk down to the stadium, you know, with all the crowd into the ground and then that's our first visit to the stadium. So we'd never even been there before. And to, you know, the way the game is going, the way sport's going, is you've got to give fans an experience. You know, you can't, you know, and when we both talk a lot about, we love those suburban grounds and going to Leichhardt Oval and going to Brookvale and going to Cogra. But, you know, when you go to a place like this and you see what is, you know, the other option, it sort of makes you think really hard about, you know, is it time to start to move away from those suburban grounds because of the experience that the fan gets at a place like Bankwest Stadium.
Yeah. So we'll move on to what was probably the biggest controversy of the weekend. You know, not the game, we always say it's the game that keeps on giving. So it tossed up another tough one for the referees this weekend in the Dragons and Manly game. So Dragons got up 12 points to 10 in a fairly tight contest. And right near the end, there was a escort on Ruben Garrick by Tim Laffey. And I guess you know, Graham Annesley has come out and said that it was incorrect and a penalty should have been awarded to Manly at that dying stage, which, you know, they potentially could have kicked a penalty goal to tie the game, you know, if it was successful and take the game into Golden Point. When we look at that decision, there are so many factors as to why it was ruled incorrectly. It was one of those decisions that it wasn't missed. It wasn't something that wasn't seen. It was just we ruled one way. We saw it and went, no, that's not enough to be a penalty. So I guess we wanted to sort of talk through why, you know, why it's a tough decision and what everyone's roles and responsibilities are on the field. Because a lot of the times you hear commentators say when a penalty is or isn't awarded or a decision, you know, might be missed or whatever it might be, you hear people say, oh, there's four people on the field. How do we miss that? How do we get it wrong? And sometimes the issue is that we don't have four people looking at the one thing because we all have a different role and responsibility. So first of all, we'll talk about what the law is.
Yeah, and we need to explain what an escort is because, you know, people hearing the word escort might be hearing that word for the first time because it's something internally that clubs use as what they're going to do in that situation. And so we then have sort of taken on that term, so it's a common language between us and the players and the club, so everyone knows what we're talking about. So probably some of the fans might not understand what an escort is.
So do you want to talk through that then?
Yeah, so it's virtually an obstruction, but it's an obstruction. It's different than when a ball player is running behind a ball player and you know, and that's the old sort of run around play and stuff like that. So it's more of an obstruction to block, and it can go both ways. It can be to block attackers from at competing for the ball in the air. It can also block defenders out of the way for jumping as well.
Yeah. So it comes after. So in a kick contest, the ball is still in the air. We've got players running towards the ball or waiting for the ball, and an escort line is a line that the player runs and can potentially block or hit a player off the ball. And there are times where it is legal, where an escort run, the player has done it correctly and it's play on, and then there are times where it's incorrect. So as you said, technically it's an obstruction.
Yes.
We don't. The law book doesn't actually have something that refers to an escort or a blocker, because according to the laws, a player is not to deliberately obstruct an opponent who is not in possession of the ball. So obviously you can obstruct the player who's got the ball because you're trying to tackle him.
Yes.
But it's illegal to obstruct anyone who doesn't have the ball. So a lot of times another criticism that sometimes comes of the game, of the NRL and of referees is, why do we have laws and interpretations? And this is a classic example of why we need our laws and interpretations and guidelines book, because to the law book, it just says you can't obstruct someone who doesn't have the ball.
Yeah.
You go, well, how many different times can that happen? That can happen, like you said, the old runaround play.
Yeah.
It can happen when a lead runner runs through and obstructs a defender. It can happen on a kick contest with these escorts. So that's why
it can also happen in support play.
Yeah.
You know, when you make a break and stuff like that. So there's times where it's legal and illegal to obstruct.
Yep. Okay, so in terms of our interpretations book, the old guidelines, I'll just go through what is a escort and what isn't an escort.
Yeah,
so what a player isn't allowed to do and what they are allowed to do. And then we can break down the incident that happened on the weekend.
Yeah, I think that's a good one to explain when. I think the biggest part for us is to explain when it is legal to do it and what we look at and how we look at it.
Yep.
So.
Okay, so it will be interpreted to be an obstruction in regards to a player catching the ball from a kick if there's 2 points to this. So the first point is if a player arrives at the same time as an opponent and obstructs him deliberately. Okay, so you can arrive at the same time because you're just chasing a ball, and that's fine. But if you arrive at the same time and deliberately obstruct them, so that could be that you've moved to the side, you've pushed your arms out, you've changed your gait at the last minute, you've changed your line.
Yep.
Okay, so that's the first point. The second point is if the player deliberately runs an opponent off the ball. So that's where we say they're not running towards the ball, where the ball's going to land. So they might be running more laterally.
Very much so, that one's the lateral run. Yep. A player will just run laterally across the field, and not to the direction that the ball's running. They're the easiest ones for us as officials to pick up.
They seem to stand out a bit more. Yeah. Okay, and then in terms of what a player can do, so it will not be considered an obstruction if a defending player moves directly towards the ball and takes up a position prior to the ball being caught.
They both have to happen.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's 2 points there. So they move directly towards the ball and take up a position prior to the ball being caught. So that's where we say the player got there early. So I can take up a position. I can run, I can stop, and if the opposition player runs into me, it's not an obstruction, because effectively I'm allowed to be standing there. They've got to go around me.
So what we look at there, the reason why we say they need to be in position, because once I'm stopped, I've now put myself in a position to catch anything that comes down. Ball comes off another player. I'm just putting myself in a position to compete for that play.
Yeah.
So that's why we say if we get the same line and stop, virtually when you look at all this and you break it all down, all we're looking for is if you're going to run that escort line, if you're going to be an escort player, that you are looking to participate in that play.
Yeah.
So if I'm always looking at the ball, always running to the ball, setting myself up, that's going to put me in good stead, and I'm going to be sweet.
Yeah.
It's, if I change something around that, so I don't run back towards the ball, if I look over my shoulder, if I change outside of competing for the ball.
Yep. Okay. So now, taking those points into consideration, we now look at the incident that happened on the weekend. So where Tim Laffey escorts Ruben Garrick. So this is where this one was quite a difficult one, because it's that crossfield kick. Tim Laffey is originally running towards the ball. Okay, so he's running in that direction. So first of all, you look at it and you go, "Yep, he's allowed to be doing that." At the last moment, when he gets near the ball. Because then his teammate then makes the jump for the ball. Tim Laffey moves laterally. So he stops and he moves sort of to the side, maybe on a little bit of an angle backwards, but it's more to the, it's, yeah, it's, he almost comes to a stop and then takes a step to his, I from memory, it was to his right. And Ruben Garrick is then coming in from the right-hand wing. From outside in to try and compete for the ball, and Tim Laffey makes contact with him. And as we said, we've come out and said that that should have been a penalty. So in that scenario, we've got the head referee, the pocket, and the two touch judges. Let's talk through the roles and responsibilities there.
Yeah, and this is something that as a group and as a squad with the referees and the touch judges, we do a fair bit of work on, because these are some of the toughest decisions we have to make, and they're also some of the biggest decisions, because they're generally, it's around the goal line. We're looking at point scoring. So we do a lot of work on how we can, you know, get these and get them correct most times. And like, everything we do, we're not going to be perfect, and there's going to be some that are, you know, rugby league's grey ones. This one, this particular incident, it's not far from being good, and it's also just not far from being no good. So it just tips over into the penalty range, I think, this one, because of the late movement. Because at the start of it, Tim Laffey's run, like you say, is the correct line. All he had to do was stop. The fact that he continued and then changed his gait then puts it into the illegal category. So it's pretty tight. So as officials, we have different focus areas. So as the assist referee, who has a fair responsibility on these crossfield kicks and escort lines, we look at any players that are coming from inside out. So you look at the players running, virtually it's your centres or, you know, your 5/8s who are coming across.
Yeah, so when we say inside out, the ones from the more middle of the field, if they're running from the middle of the field towards the touchline,
yes,
that's inside out.
So the assist ref who's behind will generally be monitoring those guys.
Yep.
And then you've got the touch judge who do the opposite. So he's outside in. Yep. So he's generally got the wingers. And depending on where the kick falls, he may have
the
centre as well.
Yep.
A lot depends where the kick falls.
Yep.
So, but there are responsibilities there. The referee also has some responsibility on what's happening there. But he also has to a lot of focus on the fullback and where he is, so the referee can position himself to get in line for a catch and contest.
So primary focus there with the head ref is that they're looking at the kick, the contest itself, because the players are going to be jumping in the air. So I need to have focus on the ball. I need to have focus on whether the players have jumped early or not.
Yeah.
And then to be able to make that ruling. And a lot of the times, these escorts that happen around that area of the field near that goal line, the referee also needs to be looking at where the player has jumped from, in terms of if they've jumped from the in goal or have a foot on the goal line, because if that player catches the ball, it's a 20-metre restart. So the referee has to go from a focus of feet. So we go feet and then up to kick contest to rule on if it's a knock-on, knock-back, whatever has happened in the air. So we talk a lot about how no one has 100% responsibility for a ruling, but it's a breakdown.
It's like a pie chart. Yeah, in particular areas of the field, in particular decisions, we have different differences of responsibility
different percentage of responsibility.
And, end of the day, everyone has some responsibility to get. As officials, we just look at it and go, well, someone has to get it right. End of the day, we just got to get it right. And, you know, it doesn't always happen, but we'd like to think that, you know, more often than not, we do.
Yep. So in this situation, you've got the kick the contest about to happen. So the actual illegal aspect of the escort of Tim Laffey happens quite late, because, like we said, he is initially running towards the ball, and it's that last sort of stop and move, which is the illegal aspect to cause a penalty. So that's what makes it hard for a head referee to see it, because
It's in a cluster of players.
In that cluster of players, and the head referee's main focus starts to shift to that next decision.
Yep.
You've got your far side touch judge, who's really not in a position to see much. So the far side touch judge would have been on and offside kick chases, and to then monitor at that kick contest, you know, if the ball's been batted back and all that sort of stuff. The set of eyes from there. Like I said, you then have your close side touch judge, who would see Ruben Garrick coming in, and then has some responsibility there on the Tim Laffey, even though he's come from inside out.
Yeah.
Because it's in that sort of proximity of that close touch judge, you hold quite a bit of responsibility for that. The difficult thing as a touch judge is being positioned on the sideline to see lateral movement. is really, really difficult. You don't get a great perception when you're in line with something of how far a player has moved laterally. Yeah. So you see when they're running the incorrect line, and you see an obvious, like, you know, when there's a push, or we say when a player looks over their shoulder. So if a player's running, in inverted commas, towards the ball, but he's looking over their shoulder at a kick chaser and then moves, it's a good indicator to us that, well, they're not competing for the ball because they're not even watching where the ball's going to come down.
They're the easy ones. And the earlier in the piece that happens, the easier it is.
Yeah.
The closer to the contest, the harder the decision.
A weight of the responsibility for that decision is on that touch judge, but that's why it's difficult. It comes late and it's a small lateral movement.
If we break that down to, like, just in normal general play, it's similar with markers for touch judges. So markers, touch judges can really easily identify when markers are deep, too deep, but very hard for when they're not square.
Like split or not square,
Because of that side view and the perception of what you're looking at. And it's very similar. I look at it as very similar in escorts.
Yeah.
When, you know, the lateral run is very hard.
Yeah. So when we watch it on TV and on the replays, we've got a higher camera angle and you see that lateral movement. What you've got to understand as spectators is that you've got a touch judge on the field who's at ground level and in line with something, and that perception is different. We train really hard. Fair play, play on. We take responsibility for the decisions we get wrong, and we work really hard at getting these right. Like you said, we do a lot. Escorts is one of the things where in a lot of our training sessions, our skills sessions and video, we work on it a lot because it is such a difficult area of the game for us.
And it's something that, like, we do a lot of skills sessions on field. It's something that, as referees, we can't emulate that. Mm. So it's very hard to get on-field practice of it.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is video working and looking at indicators and stuff, because we can't go out there and put bombs
and replicate that
to the head and jump and catch, because, firstly, we're referees for a reason, and we just don't have the skill to do that. And secondly, to do it at training, someone's going to get injured.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of video work and a lot of stuff like that. And you're talking about angles and what we're looking at, and it's not really until you look at the camera from behind, from game vision, which really sells this as a penalty.
Yeah.
Because you look at the other two angles, especially the high shot, and then you look at, you know, the game, normal game footage, and I know both of us were looking at it going, oh, is it? You know, like, that's pretty close. And then when you see the one from the front, then you see Tim Laffey's lateral movement, that's the one that sells it. Yeah. It's worth a penalty now.
Yeah.
So that shows how hard it can be depending on what position of the field you're in.
Yeah. So we've spoken about those roles. Then we have the assist referee. So on a kick, and this one is that cross-field kick which puts the assist referee in not as good position as what we would like to be in, because you can't run as fast as a ball is kicked. It's impossible.
There's also other factors as well, because part of the assist role at that stage of the game is, once there's a kick, you've also got to clear the kicker.
Yeah.
So if the kicker gets hit as he kicks, or the kicker's on the ground, or he's tackled, you can't just leave and release that incident. You've got to stay for a second.
Start running across the field.
Because all of a sudden there might be something happening on the ground. Yeah. So you've got a responsibility to look after that. So there is times where the guy who has a fair responsibility in making that decision isn't in a position to make that decision because of other factors in the game. So that's another way up that, you know, all officials on the field, once they and breaking it down, if the assist ref does have to stay at something on the ground, he will let the other officials know straight away, so that then everyone else now knows, well, we've got piece of our chain is out. We all need to adapt to make sure that we can try and get this.
Say there was a tackle on that kicker, and the assist referee needed to stay with that contact on the ground, they would give comms to the rest of the team to say, I'm out. And like you said, that gets everyone else to know, well, geez, I've got to take more responsibility now for this next decision. So in this scenario, it doesn't have, we don't have contact on the ground, which the assist ref needs to stay with. But what happens is that you can't start running across the field as the assist referee immediately. You can't just take off like it's the start of a
that
sprint
kick.
Because, well, you've also got to just delay. You've got to go, okay, I've got to wait 1 second, make sure that nothing's happened. All right, now I can go. So first of all, it's impossible to run as fast as the ball is kicked. So you're already going to be behind it.
Yep.
Then two, you can't take off as soon as the ball's kicked, because you've got to linger for that second before you can take off. So then the assist ref's role is to run laterally across the field. We don't worry so much about running towards the ball because for us, when you speak about the camera angle from behind, that's virtually what we want to get.
That's the view we want.
That's the view we want. So we run across the field as fast as we can to look at those players, mostly as the assist ref, like you said, working from inside out.
Yes.
To then see it. So ideally between, you know, assist ref, touch judge, near side touch judge, head ref, ideally we would have gotten that decision. And, you know, as a squad, we put our hands up and say, yes, we got that wrong. But these are the factors around why it is so difficult.
But this is the thing in this decision. It was a decision that was, like, and I know you brought it up earlier, it's not like, and you know, we just didn't see anything and, yeah. No, and no one's made it. We had officials in position who, at that stage, and what they saw in front of them, made a decision, and the decision was that that was a legal play by Tim Laffey.
Yeah, that he got there early enough and stopped.
The head referee, okay. David Munro, who is probably has, without trying to take away from it, the least responsibility in the decision, actually has an inkling that there is something there, who asks a question of the other officials,
yep.
And the other officials come in
and clear it.
And make that decision that play's fine.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you break it all down, the system or the process isn't broken.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just a decision that we got wrong.
Yeah.
Like we do with other decisions in the middle of the field, whether it be around knock-ons, forward passes, whatever. Sometimes we just make wrong decisions. Sometimes we've taken all the factors and like I said, especially when they're tight, we're going to get some of them wrong.
And we spoke last week around your game and talking about where things happen and we say, like, we're hurting. And we know that the referees in that game, it's not a good feeling. You know?
Well, yeah, and you know, we're pretty tight with Dave as well, who is a really good mate, is almost like family to us. And yeah, I really felt for him because I know how, you know, the week before, and Dave's sort of, you know, hasn't had a lot of exposure to negative media and stuff like that. So it's a pretty big weekend for him as well. So, you know, and as I said last week, the squad gets around Dave and makes sure that, you know, we're all big boys and we can all handle that stuff. But sometimes, you know, when you're down and, you know, all it takes is a mate's phone call that can help. And I think as our squad, we do that really well. And we've done that well for Dave this week.
And it's a strange thing that happens in where we say as the rest of the team, as the two touch judges and as the assist referee, we work for the head referee. We work for that. If the head referee has a good performance, we all have a good performance. We say if the head ref wins, we win.
Yeah.
So in something like this where, yes, there's responsibility on Dave, but we also have a responsibility on the other two people, they're not the names that are out in the public.
Yes, that's right.
The name that gets out in the public when there's a you know, a big controversy is always the head referee's name, whether it's there.
Except for last week when my name was out there as well. How come that didn't fall into place?
Usually the name is that of the head referee.
Yeah,
so we say that the head referee is the one who wears the heat for decisions, whether they own that decision or not. They're the ones who wear the heat. And that's the pressure that comes with being one of the top referees in our game. If you're in the position to be a head referee,
you
wear the heat.
You're the team captain, yeah. And you have a lot of responsibility around how that team's run for that week. And we look at it as, you know, each week we go into teams as a group because we're not together every week. So between, you know, the four on-field officials and the match day coach, you know, that head ref organises that week virtually for that team and, you know, training sessions and, you know.
What time we're going to get together to chat.
You know, if it's a way trip, they're sort of in charge of organising, you know, lunch and.
Yeah.
It's just something that there's a fair amount of responsibility on it. So when something like this does happen, there is a fair heat on that individual, whether it be externally or internally.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this week we're actually recording this podcast at an earlier time. So, and with the Monday game yesterday, which is, you know, out of normal scheduling for us, we weren't able to get the GPS data for this week. But what we'll make sure we do is next week we'll make sure we let everyone know who won those awards. So we thought we'd just have a quick, you know, just give you a little bit of an insight into a couple of our team members. We thought we'd add in this little segment of getting to know the squad, and throughout this season, you know, every now and then when we've got a bit of time in this podcast, we'll let you know a few things about one or two of the full-time squad members.
And just quickly, the guys don't know that we're about to have a little we may have shots at certain guys at certain times. And
it's all in fun.
Yeah, maybe. But they don't know this is coming, so we may lose some friends here.
All right, so we've just picked two guys, two of our head referees generally. This week we'll talk a little bit about Jerry Sutton and Grant Atkins. So Jerry Sutton, he started as a 12-year-old referee in Coonabarabran, so northwestern New South Wales.
Was it legal to referee at 12 years old?
Absolutely not.
I think he's broken the laws here, hasn't he?
So currently you can start refereeing as a 13-year-old. Until a couple of years ago, it used to be 14, but in some regional areas, you see things like that, like this happen, unfortunately.
Lack of numbers and stuff, you just need to...
It happens much. It doesn't happen anymore, but back when Jerry would have started refereeing, things weren't monitored as much and you were sort of allowed to do it. So you think about that as a 12-year-old. If anyone's got any of our listeners have kids out there, think about what your 12-year-old's like and think if he or she, how they'll handle themselves on a field. It's a pretty big task.
I think I was still eating dirt at 12.
pretty big testament to probably Jerry's maturity at that age to be able to handle refereeing. From northwestern New South Wales, and he moved to Sydney in 1999, which was a big decision. So to progress, he made the decision to progress, try and progress on and pursue refereeing.
Yeah, it was purely a refereeing-based decision to move to Sydney. That's a big move for a young kid out of Coonah, head to the big smoke to pursue. Yeah, it's not your normal dreams, is it, to referee rugby league at the highest level?
And it's not like he moved there with any guarantee, because it took 10 years for him to then debut, in the middle. So he moved to Sydney in 99 and he debuted as a referee in 2009. So a lot of hard work to get there. And outside of refereeing, he was a journalist.
Yeah.
So good, very good storyteller, Jerry.
He's got the gift of the gab, Jerry. What about his nickname? He's got a nickname.
He's got the greatest nickname within our squad, which was formed last year. I think it actually came from his little brother started.
Doesn't
it.
But surprise
we made this nickname stick of Big Slice.
Why the Big Slice?
We called him Big Slice because we said that he was taking up the biggest slice of our salary cap as referees.
And this may or may not be true, this story I'm about to tell, but earlier in the year, Casey refereed a trial at Belmore, and Jerry and a few others came out to watch, and he was there with his family. And the story I'm telling is that when he went to the canteen to buy... some hot dog and chips, he only had a $100 bill because that's all he carries and they couldn't change it for him.
I don't know if Jerry's going to like this podcast this week.
So that's the story is that he carries nothing less than hundreds.
So that's Jerry Sutton, Big Slice. Next person we'll talk about is Grant Atkins.
Yeah,
do you want to talk a bit about Joey?
Yeah, well there you go, Joey. So Grant Atkins, we'll start with his nickname. So his nickname's Joey. I've got to be careful how I word this, but Joey, a couple of years ago when he was running around in lower grades, was a little bit bigger than he is at the moment, and he got the nickname Joey because it was referenced to the eighth immortal
Andrew Johns,
and a particular part of Joey's Grant's body looked like Andrew Johns, and so he got the nickname Joey, and it's got nothing to do with his football skills, although he'll try and tell you that he can play the game. And a little bit of a sidetrack to that, it's a little bit of a different story with Grant. Most people follow, if they're going to follow their parents into a particular avenue, they sort of follow that avenue. So Grant's dad, Graham Atkins, actually, I think it was 1975, debuted for Parramatta, actually scored a try in their first ever grand final win. And, I think it was 150-odd first-grade games he played. And you think about back in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot less games of footy as well. Mm. So to play 150 games was a huge achievement. So... I like to think that it's Joey's lack of football ability that got him into refereeing, but he often says it is because of his football ability that makes him a good referee. Decided to referee, and as I think he's got the potential to be, a guy that's around for a long time and does a lot of big games. But he started refereeing in Penrith, Penrith Junior. I know he's really well respected in that area and still does a little bit of stuff with referees in district and helps out where he can. And he's a high school teacher by trade. Mm. I think his specialty is geography.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he likes travelling a bit. Now, one thing I'll tell you about Grant Atkins is that, and he thinks he's very funny, and he is the he's the king of the dad jokes. If you want to hear a pretty ordinary joke, Grant's willing to throw it out there. So, yeah, just a little bit of an insight into a couple of the guys. And
so yeah, we'll throw that little segment in when we can, when we've got a bit of time to let everyone know, you know, a little bit about the full-time squad.
As we go along, something that you will find out about is that we're not real funny, and we're not real, you know, some of the nicknames of some of the guys are pretty ordinary.
Big Slice is one of the better ones.
That's why we get that one out of the way early.
So this weekend we head into the Anzac round, and this year just want to have a little special mention of the jerseys that the referees will be wearing. So for our listeners out there, have a little look at the jerseys that the referees have got on, because for the first time we've had some input into the design of those jerseys, and down the side we'll have the names of any family members of our referee squad who served.
Yeah, and I really got to go. A lot of credit to Jerry Sutton around this. And this is something that I know, this is a bit of a passion for Jerry. I know he's traced his family in different wars and stuff. And he brought it to the squad and sort of put it to us that, you know, this would be something that would be really good. Last year, I was fortunate enough to referee the Anzac Day game.
The Roosters Dragons
game. Yeah, and we wore a really nice commemorative jersey. And it was good. And I, a few of us have passed them on to different people who served and different referees, where this year to have names on the jerseys and be able to, you know, some of the guys, you know, be able to give that to, you know, still members of the family that are living that served, is quite an honour. So, yeah, I really want to give a big
rap
to Jerry for organising. And also, you know, the NRL for allowing us to do it. You know, it's, like I said, it's the first time we've had any input into any of our jerseys. And hopefully going forward, when it comes to special jerseys, we get a bit more of a say in it. And when it comes to Indigenous round, women in league round and stuff like that, where, you know, instead of... Yeah, and you know, I'm someone who's, you know, proud to wear all those jerseys, but if you have some input into it, it just means a little bit more.
Yeah, makes it really special. All right, so with that, we'd like to encourage you, as always, to join our Facebook and Instagram pages. Facebook page is NRL Officiating, and the Instagram handle is @NRLOfficiating. So give us a follow to keep up to date with what's happening in the world of rugby league officials across the country, from under sixes through to the NRL. Do you have anything else to say to the listeners, Gav?
No, just enjoy your weekend.
Yep.
Anzac Day's coming up, so
yep.
Behave yourselves.
So have fun, and thank you to everyone out there who has served, and to their family members who have served the country. And hope you have a good time this weekend with Anzac Day. See you next week.
Bye.